All right, let's go ahead and get started this evening, and thank you all for being here. We're probably going to spend one more evening, and I know I had promised to get to Daniel chapter 1, but I might have lied. That's the best I can tell you. I might have lied. We may hit Daniel chapter 1, verse 1, but I'm certainly not going to make that promise, because there's a few things that I want to cover before we get into the book of Daniel, and that having to do with Israel. A lot of people don't understand a lot of the events of the Old Testament, and this is a particularly interesting time in the Old Testament, because it's really a switch from God dealing exclusively with Israel and the nation Israel to God using the Gentile nations and giving supremacy, world domination to Gentile nations, and that domination over Israel too. This is at this point we find the 10 tribes of Israel have gone into captivity prior by the Assyrian Empire, and then the book of Daniel deals with events during the captivity of Judah and Benjamin during that Babylonian captivity. So one of the things that I wanted to cover this evening, since what we're going to deal with in Daniel is Judah, the two tribes of Judah, which comprises Judah and Benjamin, that you still got 10 tribes, and commonly it is said that those 10 tribes got lost. Now, they didn't have GPS or MapQuest back then, and they're still out there wandering around trying to find their way. That was the teaching of Herbert W. Armstrong, for instance, who I mentioned earlier, Worldwide Church of God. He built a whole theology around 10 lost tribes and how they became Britain and the United States. British Israelism is what that's called. Of course, if you go there, that makes us Manasseh and Britain, Ephraim, and you can then find us in prophecy if that's who we would be. You could find us in prophecy, and you could foretell exactly what's going to happen to this nation and the nation of England and all these different things. Well, it's a popular teaching, and it has been for years. It's just wrong. That's the problem with it. It's just wrong. So what we're going to start with, the northern kingdom of Israel, that would be the 10 tribes other than Judah and Benjamin, which, again, we deal with those two tribes, not exclusively, but predominantly in the book of Daniel. The kingdom of Israel, they were exhorted, they were invaded, extorted, they were invaded, they were conquered, taken captive primarily by the Assyrian monarchs, the Assyrian kings, and the Assyrian Empire. That is the world empire that dominated prior to the Babylonian Empire. The Bible doesn't happen in a vacuum, and there are other things going on in the world at the same time that Jeremiah is writing, at the same time that Ezekiel's writing, at the same time that Israel, it goes into captivity. There's other events happening in the world, so you see a microcosm of the world, and you see all those things that deal directly with Israel through the eyes of the Bible. But understand, there's a whole nother, the rest of the world is still moving on. It didn't stop just because Israel went into captivity. But meanwhile, you find some names, Tilgath-Pileser. I know these are strange, strange names. And his son, Shalmaneser, there you go. These are Assyrian rulers. And Sargon is mentioned in your Bible, S-A-R-G-O-N. Sargon and his son and successor, I'll just have to spell it for you. I think it's Sennacherib, S-E-N-N-A-C-H-E-R-I-B, Sennacherib. They were wholly responsible for finishing off the captivity of Israel. When you read the Bible, I've said this before and I'll say it again, that a lot of times we read and think that these things are happening really quickly, because one verse will say something and the next verse will say something different, and you think, wow, you know, time's really moving on, because we're used to being able to get on a jet plane and in, you know, a couple hours being down there on the beach in Florida, you throw a dinner in the microwave and a minute later it comes out. And so we kind of read that fast movement into the Bible. The fact of the matter is, there can be years or decades involved in one verse. So you have to read the context, and you have to be a little more of a workman when you're dealing with the Bible. It doesn't necessarily happen overnight, all these things. Well, Sargon's successor, Sennacherib, he also invaded some parts of the southern kingdom of Judah. And he recorded some 46 fortified towns taken from Judah. So his conquests, you know, extensive. There's a lot of warring going on. And here's what you're going to see. The Gentile nations, first of all, there's not a whole lot changed over the years. That's one thing you're going to see. It's like the game of Risk. You know, that game where you roll the dice and you got the armies and you're trying to conquer the world. This is really what's going on. And there's different kingdoms and there's different people, and at different times, one gains the advantage over the other. And so there are those who dominate for a time, and then, of course, they fall. You know, the United States, I do remember one thing that Herbert W. Armstrong used to preach, and I think I'd have to agree with him. He used to preach the downfall of the United States, and saying one of these days we as an economic, you know, megathon, you know, economic giant, our time is going to come to an end. I don't see any reason to doubt that, because, you know, there's never been the nation on this earth that has come into power and become dominant in the world. The United States, for instance, we're dominant in the world, but you can look around and see that dominance is slipping away even as I speak. Countries like China, countries even like Russia are coming more to the forefront. The Arab countries, all, you know, they're a whole lot richer than we are. My goodness, they're building sand islands and putting paradises on top of them, you know. We ought to just move over there, I guess, closer to the oil. Meanwhile, that's one thing that I would have to say that I agree with him, that the economic dominance of the United States probably will come to an end one of these days. And that's nothing new, though. I mean, it's nothing to get terribly excited about, because every kingdom, every world power has had its time and then faded away at some point. So I don't know why we would think we're any better or any different. But meanwhile, Jerusalem was besieged but not taken by the Assyrians. And the tribes exiled by Assyria later became known in some theologies as the Lost Ten Tribes. And you'll hear that, the Lost Ten Tribes of Israel. Well, let's take a look at the Bible and see what the Bible has to say. If you turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 26, you're going to get a workout in the Old Testament here, aren't you? You're going to learn where all these books are in the Old Testament. The captivities, now these dates, I'm not going to set them in stone. So you're just going to have to take the dates with a grain of salt. Scholarship people, a whole lot smarter than I am, have come up with some of these dates, and I'm going to use them and just tell you, take them with a little bit of salt there. But the captivity began in approximately 740 B.C., so that's about the time that we're talking about. That the tribes of Reuben and Gad and the eastern half of the tribe of Manasseh were carried away by one of the first successful Assyrian invasions. And in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 26, you read, "And the Elohim of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul," that would be Tilgarth-Pileser, the third, who I mentioned before. A lot of characters in the Bible have more than one name. Understand that. Pul, king of Assyria, and the spirit of Tilgath-Pileser, king of Assyria. It's the same guy. "And he carried them away even unto the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and brought them unto Hala and Haber and Hara and unto the river Gozan unto this day." Now, I'm not going to... Those places are, I'll just tell you, are generally in the Middle East Arab countries. That's where they went into. And the Assyrian Empire encompasses those countries, all the way to the northern part of modern day Israel, just above Samaria, over to Saudi Arabia and you know, Babylon, or I'm saying Babylon, that doesn't even exist anymore. Iran, Iraq, part of Turkey, all these countries, these Middle East countries that make the headlines every day. This is the Assyrian Empire at that time. That's exactly where it was located. Look at 2 Kings in chapter 15, verse 29. Now, what you're going to find, if you're not familiar with the Old Testament, is that Chronicles and Kings often parallel each other, just like the four Gospels do, and the account of the Lord's earthly ministry. But the fact of the matter is this: you're going to get different bits of information. You don't get the whole story from one or the other. You have to read them both and put the pieces together. Meanwhile, 2 Kings 15:29, in the days of Pekah, the king of Israel, came. So Pekah was the king of Israel, came Tilgath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and took Ijon and another town that, yeah, I hear the chuckles out there. He conquered a whole lot of places, and he carried the captives off to Assyria. Okay, so, and that in 722 B.C. then, that would be what, 18 years later, the ruling city of the northern kingdom of Israel, which was Samaria. Samaria. Now, you hear about Samaria and the Samaritans in the Gospels. That's just north of Jerusalem. And that was finally taken by Sargon. And that after a three-year siege, which was started by Shalmaneser. So you find all these things. Look at 2 Kings chapter 17, verse 3. There's a point to all this madness, I promise you. Against him came up Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, and Hoshea became his servant. Hoshea, of course, king of Israel, became his servant and gave him presents. And the king of Assyria found conspiracy in Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and brought no present to the king of Assyria, as he had done year by year. Therefore, the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. It's interesting. As you go through these chronicles and through the history, Israel at times is friendly with Egypt, and counts on them for protection. And then at other times, Egypt is not necessarily their friend. So it's kind of like Saudi Arabia and all the countries that we deal with, isn't it? They, you know, they're friendly as long as they're getting what they want, and then they'll turn around and stab you in the back. Verse 5. The king of Assyria came up and throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it 3 years. And in the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away into Assyria, placed them in Hala and Haber by the river Gozan in the cities of the Medes. Well, so there you go. There's the account of the Israel, the 10 tribes of Israel, being carried away into the cities of the Medes, into the land of Assyria. The tribes of the northern kingdoms, they're often spoke of as those lost 10 tribes, but I'm going to tell you that's wrong. It's claimed, and a lot of doctrines are based upon that claim, that no remnant or trace of these tribes ever returned or remained in the promised land. Now, if that's true, then they would never again show up in your Bible, would they? But, however, this is not the fact. For example, turn to Luke chapter 2, verse 36. Luke chapter 2, verse 36. We find a character named Anna. A character named Anna. And in Luke chapter 2, verse 36, there was one Anna, a prophetess, the daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. She was of a great age, and she had lived with her husband 7 years from her virginity. That was one of the 10 tribes. So here we go. We find a descendant, a member of one of the 10 tribes, contemporary with the Lord in Jerusalem. And so that is one example. I would tell you that not only would some of the members of the 10 tribes made their way back to Judah before, during, and after the Assyrian attack, you know, it would have been impossible for them to round up every last person. Some would have escaped, but some would have already been living, among the people of Judah and Benjamin. And in the time of Josiah, and we're going to start a little bit of a history and follow the progression of kings unto the kings that we deal with in Daniel. But in the time of Josiah, if you turn to 2 Chronicles 35 in verse 1, 2 Chronicles 35, verse 1. As soon as I get there, we'll... Here we go. In the time of Josiah, he was king of Israel, when the Passover observance was restored, it was kept... Well, we'll just see. Look in verse 1. This was during the reign of Josiah after the tribes of Israel had gone into captivity from the Assyrian conquest. So that's your time frame. 2 Chronicles 35:1, moreover, Josiah kept a Passover unto the Lord in Jerusalem, and they killed the Passover on the 14th day of the first month. That would be the right thing. Skip down to verse 17. And the children of Israel, the children of Israel that were present, kept the Passover at that time and the Feast of Unleavened Bread 7 days. Well, we haven't proved anything yet because, as we know from the New Testament, Israel, the Jew, all these things can be, those names can be substituted one for another. But in verse 18, we find the delineation of the different tribes. There was no Passover like it that was kept in Israel from the days of Samuel the prophet. Neither did all the kings of Israel keep such a Passover as Josiah kept. And the priests, and the Levites, and all Judah and Israel that were present. So here you find that after the Assyrian conquest of the 10 tribes that supposedly got lost, amazingly enough, you find people from those 10 tribes with the people of Judah, and they're celebrating the Passover in the time of Josiah, and along with the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And that was in the 18th year of the reign of Josiah. Well, if you're in 2 Chronicles, look at 2 Chronicles chapter 35 in verse 20. And I want to lead us into the time of the writing of the book of Daniel and the events so that you see and have a good grasp on the context of what's going on. 2 Chronicles 35, verse 20. After all this, when Josiah had prepared the temple, Necho, king of Egypt. Now, Necho, king of Egypt, is going to be the last king, the last pharaoh of Egypt that gives Israel any real problems at this time before they go into captivity. And matter of fact, old Necho, that's the guy the wafers are named after, by the way, the Necho wafers. Old Necho is going to have some problems with Nebuchadnezzar. And you're going to see that. So up to this time, you had the Assyrians in the north. You had the Egyptians who were powerful, but losing power. Their light was dimming, and their light was fading, as far as a world power goes. And after all this, Josiah had prepared the temple. Necho, king of Egypt, came up to fight against Carchemish by Euphrates, and Josiah went out against him. So the king of Egypt went out against Carchemish. But he sent ambassadors to Necho, is what it is, saying, "What have I to do with thee, thou king of Judah?" Or Necho sent ambassadors to Josiah, is what amounts to. "What have I to do with thee?" In other words, what are you coming out here to fight with me for? "I come not against thee this day, but against the house wherewith I have war, for God commanded me to make haste." Isn't that an interesting statement coming from Necho, the Pharaoh of Egypt? "God commanded me to make haste. Forbear thee from meddling with God, who is with me, that he destroy thee not." So in other words, Necho is warning the king of Israel, Josiah, not to meddle in the affairs that were going on so that Josiah and Israel would not be destroyed. I just want to make a comment here that what you're going to find out is that throughout this period of time, and throughout the Old Testament as a whole, but you're going to see example after example, God shows His sovereignty, God shows His authority, God shows His power through His workings concerning both the Gentile nations and Israel. And that's the point of the lesson. You need to keep that in mind. God is showing His sovereignty, showing that He is God. And so when things happen, God shows His power. God shows that He is the one in charge, and He's the one commanding all these events. People today look for that very same thing, don't they? You know, they all want to have a sign from God. They all want to believe that God is manipulating all these events. And, you know, God is the one who told the terrorists to get on the planes and fly into the Twin Towers. And God's the one that takes the hurricane and directs it against New Orleans because, you know, New Orleans is so much worse than, let's say, Las Vegas or San Diego. You know, we're in a different dispensation. A dispensation where heaven is silent, where God is letting things progress as they will. Things are moving along just fine. And you see the forerunners of prophetic occurrence, but you're not seeing prophecy fulfilled. Meanwhile, at this time, things were different. God had a hand in the nations, and God set rulers in place, and here you go. Nevertheless, verse 22, Josiah would not turn his face from him, but disguised himself that he might fight with him. So Josiah decides he's going to fight with old Necho Wafer, and so he puts on a disguise and hearkened not unto the words of Necho from the mouth of God and came to fight in the valley of Megiddo. Well, there's going to be a famous place once again. There's been a lot of battles fought in the Valley of Megiddo. And that is where the Battle of Armageddon is going to take place. It's a huge open valley. If you've ever seen pictures of it, it's a huge open plain, lots of room for lots of armies and things like that. But meanwhile, all kinds of battles have happened there over the centuries throughout history. So then we move on to verse 23, the archer shot at King Josiah. And the king said to his servants, have me away, for I am sore wounded. In other words, I'm about ready to kick the bucket. Verse 24, his servants therefore took him out of that chariot and put him in the second chariot that he had, and they brought him to Jerusalem, and he died. Well, so that was the end of Josiah, because he meddled in the affairs of God. So he was killed by God. Now that's one of these instances, as you're going to learn, that you could say, well, had he not meddled in the affairs of God, things would have turned out different. But he did, and things didn't. So after the death of Josiah, we find another character come on the scene, Jehoahaz. And he, in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 1, begins to reign. Then the people of the land took Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, and we're going to find out that Josiah had at least three sons, and made him king in his father's stead in Jerusalem. Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. Not a very long reign, was it? And Jehoahaz was deposed by Necho, king of Egypt. So the same Necho man that invented the wafers, he was the one who told Josiah not to meddle in the affairs because he had been given instruction by God. And Josiah died from meddling. Well, here comes Jehoahaz, and he is deposed by this very same Necho, king of Egypt, in verse 3, 2 Chronicles chapter 36, and the king of Egypt put him down at Jerusalem and condemned the land in 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold. And then we find Eliakim, who is going to be renamed Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah also, and he reigns. Here's another son of Josiah. 2 Chronicles 36, verse 4, and the king of Egypt made Eliakim his brother over Judah and Jerusalem and turned his name to Jehoiakim. Do you see, as we go through here, how God is using Necho, Pharaoh of Egypt, to carry out his will and to put kings in place over Israel? Isn't that an interesting thing? And Necho took Jehoahaz, his brother, and carried him to Egypt. Sorry, I'm having trouble breathing. The allergy season is upon me. In about 609 BC, if I had to put a year on it, that's about the year I'd put on it. 609 BC, verse 5, Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem, and he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord his God. Well, what we're going to find out was evil in the sight of the Lord his God was mainly this, that Jeremiah the prophet was warning these people to accept whatever Gentile nation came and ruled over them and just lay back, you know, take it for granted, this is the way it's going to be. And you find king after king after king who decide they're going to conspire to try to overthrow the ruler of Babylon and all this, and it doesn't work out very well for them. In about 606 BC, there's another year for you, and that year is contentious in its exact date, but you can take it for whatever it's worth. Jerusalem is attacked for the first time by the Chaldeans. Now, the Bible tells us that the Chaldeans, their capital city of Babylon, owed their empire, for the most part, to the Assyrians, because they basically take over the same ground that the Assyrians had once commanded. And we're going to find out that the Babylonian Empire also encompasses some of Egypt and is also going to reign over that which the Assyrians had not captured, that Jerusalem. In 2 Chronicles 36, 6, against him, that would be against Jehoiakim, came up Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and bound him in fetters to carry him to Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar also carried the vessels of the house of the Lord to Babylon and put them in the temple at Babylon. Well, so that was the first assault by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, king of the Chaldeans, on Jerusalem. There's going to be multiple assaults over a number of years. Again, I would remind you, none of these things, first of all, happened in a vacuum, and none of these things just happen in the amount of time it takes you to read the verse. You're talking about sieges that lasted for weeks, months, and sometimes years to accomplish, and there were multiple sieges. If you had to pick a date, write down 605 BC. Because here comes Pharaoh Necho, and he is defeated by the Chaldeans. This same Nebuchadnezzar defeats Pharaoh and puts him down. So you see then the domination that's occurring by the Babylonian Empire. They make their first assault on Jerusalem and win, and now they're going to go against Egypt, who up to that time had been kind of a co-player along with the Assyrians. Jeremiah chapter 46 is where we're going to go. And we will be there for a few minutes. Jeremiah chapter 46, verse 1. Just as soon as I get there, we'll be set to go. And in verse 1, the word of the Lord came unto Jeremiah the prophet against the Gentiles. Well, what does that tell you? First of all, Jeremiah is going to prophesy things against the Gentiles. Now, that would not be in favor of the Gentiles. God still regards Israel at this point as his chosen people. And he is having these things come about in order to teach them a lesson. So it's not really for the benefit of the Gentiles, whether it be Pharaoh Necho, whether it be the Assyrian kings, whether it be Nebuchadnezzar. None of them are the concern of God. He uses them for the benefit or the admonition of the nation Israel. The word of the Lord came unto Jeremiah, and against Egypt, verse 2, against the army of Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, which was by the river Euphrates in Carchemish, which Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, smote in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, son of Josiah, king of Judah. Well, turn, hold right there in Jeremiah 44. Turn to Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. Yeah, I told you we'd get to one verse anyway. And this is your big chance. Now, we just read Jeremiah talking about Nebuchadnezzar coming up against the Egyptian king, Pharaoh Necho, in the fourth year of Jehoiakim and his reign. Notice verse 1, chapter 1 of Daniel. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah came to Nebuchadnezzar, came of Babylon unto Jerusalem and besieged it. So the year before, Egypt was conquered by Nebuchadnezzar. He seized Jerusalem. So it kind of gives you an idea. Old Nebuchadnezzar, he was on the move. And he wasn't just picking on Israel. He was conquering. So back to Jeremiah, chapter 46, verse 13. Go down to there. The word of the Lord spake to Jeremiah the prophet, how Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, should come and smite the land of Egypt. Verse 15, why are they thy valiant men swept away? They stood not because the Lord did drive them. Notice it's the Lord that's driving away these warriors, that's making them fall. He made many to fall. That's the Lord making many valiant warriors to fall. Yea, one fell upon another, and they said, arise, and let us go again to our own people in the land of our nativity from the oppressing sword. There they did cry, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, is but a noise. He hath passed the time appointed. So when you hear people talk about, well, God puts leaders in place, leaders of nations and things, they're referring to the Old Testament. That was absolutely true at that time. The Lord was showing the Gentile nations and Israel that he was King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He was God Almighty. He was Jehovah God. Jeremiah chapter 46, skip down to verse 25. The Lord of hosts, notice capital L-O-R-D, that's Jehovah God. That's who you mainly deal with in the Old Testament. I need to get a drink here. The Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, saith, behold, I will punish the multitude of No and Pharaoh and Egypt with their gods and their kings, even Pharaoh and all them that trust in him. So that was, there was a lot of allegiance to Pharaoh and a lot of allies with Pharaoh. I will deliver them into the hands of those that seek their lives, and into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of his servants. And afterwards it shall be inhabited as in the days of old, saith the Lord. But fear not thou, O my servant Jacob. So here's the consolation to the nation of Israel. Fear not, and be not dismayed, O Israel, for behold, I will save thee from afar off, and thy seed from the land of their captivity. And Jacob shall return, and shall be in rest and at ease, and none shall make him afraid. Verse 28, fear thou not, O Jacob, my servant, saith the Lord, for I am with thee, for I will make a full end of all the nations whither I have driven thee, but I will not make a full end of thee, but correct thee in measure, yet will I not leave thee wholly unpunished. So, it's a punishment. The captivities are just flat out that. A punishment. A correction. God's taking corrective measures against his covenant people, Israel, and showing them what's what. Deuteronomy chapter 28, I would remind you, is full of, first of all, blessings, but mainly cursings. And Israel has the if if-then relationship with God. If you do this, then God would do that. If you don't do it, then God gives you a whole different set of promises, and that's what you see coming true here. After that goes on, turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 36. 2 Chronicles chapter 36. I'm really trying to make a little bit of sense out of the Old Testament, this little section of history, and show you that multiple prophets and multiple books deal with these events. 2 Chronicles chapter 36 verse 8. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim, that was the one that we just read about, in Jeremiah, the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim and his abominations which he did, and that which were found in him, behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Israel and Judah. So you can find writings about him in Kings. And Jehoiakim, his son, reigned, and Jehoiachin, I'm sorry, his son reigned in his stead. So Jehoiakim is replaced by his son Jehoiachin. Now you got to keep these names straight. Hold your finger in 2 Chronicles 36 and also look at 2 Kings chapter 24. 2 Kings chapter 24. You need to be aware that this is one place in your Bible that, among other people, the Muslims are going to take you to try to disprove the authenticity and perfection of your Bible. Every Muslim knows this. And a whole lot of Christians use the very same argument, by the way. So Christians are no better. They're going to, when you say the King James Authorized Version is God's perfectly preserved word, this is chances are this is one of the places they're going to take you to and try to leave you hanging. Second Chronicles chapter 36 verse 9 is what we need up there on the screen for the Pal Talk folks. 2 Chronicles 36 verse 9. Jehoiachin was 8 years old when he began to reign. There it is. Jehoiachin was 8 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 3 months and 10 days in Jerusalem, and he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. So how old was Jehoiachin? 8. How long did he reign? 3 months, 10 days in Jerusalem. Okay? Read with me 2 Kings chapter 24, starting in verse 8 and 9. Jehoiachin was 18 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned in Jerusalem 3 months. And his mother's name was Nehushta, I guess is it, that's how you say that, the daughter of Elnathan of Jerusalem. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father had done. Well, I just saw a horrified look saying, ooh, how can that be? Because 2 Chronicles does say 8 years old. 2 Kings says Jehoiachin was 18 years old. What's the solution to the problem? Is one of the verses wrong, or is the Bible still perfect in its every word? 2 Kings chapter 24 in verse 8, we find that Jehoiachin was 18 years old when he began to reign in Jerusalem, and he reigned in Jerusalem 3 months. And then it speaks about his mother. He did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. If you keep reading, verse 10, at that time the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against Jerusalem, and the city was besieged. And Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came against the city, and his servants did besiege it. In verse 12, Jehoiachin, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon, he and his mother. And then you find also in verse 15 that all these people get carried away to Babylon, and he carried away Jehoiachin to Babylon and the king's mother. Mama was co-regent with Jehoiachin. And Jehoiachin was not reigning by himself at 8 years old. At 8 years old, he did not do that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, as 2 Chronicles 36 might lead you to believe if you don't have, as a cross-reference, 2 Kings 24, 8, and 9. As a matter of fact, from 8 years to 18 years of age, Jehoiachin was co-regent with his mama. And she played a very important part. That is the time period that is not recorded by 2 Chronicles, and that makes the difference. Because at 18, then he became old enough to reign by himself. He reigned 3 months and 10 days, got a big head, and did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord at that point. So Jehoiachin was actually around for 10 years, 3 months and 10 days, or somewhere about that neighborhood. But from the age of 8 to 18, he was co-regent, and that is not, you have to get that out of 2 Kings. So there's no contradiction in the verses whatsoever. It's just the fact of the matter that when you deal with the Bible, not every account of an instance is going to give you all the information. You have to go to the other accounts. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are a perfect example of that very same thing. The next thing we look at in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, starting in verse 10 this time, is Zedekiah. Zedekiah is Judah's last king. Israel, the 10 tribes, have already lost their kingdom. They're in captivity. And Judah's last king is Zedekiah. And this is, in fact, Josiah's third son, and it's Jehoiakim's uncle. And at this point, Jerusalem and the temple are going to be destroyed. During these periods of time, during these kings that we've looked at, each time the king did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord sends Nebuchadnezzar or his cohorts to attack Jerusalem and besieges it and carries off people. There are multiple sieges over multiple years, the first of which was about 606 B.C. But meanwhile, this is going to be the last siege, and that during the reign of Zedekiah. 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 10, and when the year was expired, King Nebuchadnezzar sent and brought him to Babylon with the goodly vessels of the house of the Lord and made Zedekiah his brother king over Judah and Jerusalem. So Jehoiakim was 8 years old when he began to co-reign with his mother, is what it amounts to. When he was 18, he reigned for 3 months and 10 days in Jerusalem, did that was evil, which was evil in the sight of the Lord. And when the year was up, King Nebuchadnezzar sent and brought him to Babylon. All this time, the kings of Judah, the kings that are ruling over Jerusalem, are being told by Jeremiah, the prophet, to be subservient to Nebuchadnezzar and to the Babylonian rule. And they keep ignoring Jeremiah, do they not, and getting deposed. You would think sooner or later one of them would have learned, but that's just not the case. So Zedekiah is put over Judah and Jerusalem. Zedekiah, verse 11, was 120 years old when he began to reign and reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord his God, and humbled not himself before Jeremiah the prophet, speaking from the mouth of the Lord. There you go. There's exact explanation of what's going on. Jeremiah was put in place to give advice and prophecy to these kings, and they refused to listen. And verse 13, he also rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar, who had made him swear by God, but he stiffened his neck and hardened his heart from turning of the Lord God of all Israel. Moreover, all the chief of the priests and the people transgressed very much after all the abominations of the heathen and polluted the house of the Lord which had been hallowed in Jerusalem. So things got worse and worse. And then here comes Zedekiah and things really go bad. And the Lord God of their fathers sent to them by his messengers, rising in bedtimes and sending, or rising up betimes and sending, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. In other words, he had sent him prophets, he had sent him messengers, he had given them break after break. But, verse 16, they mocked the messengers of God and despised his words and misused his prophets until the wrath of the Lord rose against his people till there was no remedy. There was nothing they could have done at that point. Therefore, he brought upon them, that's God, he brought upon them the king of the Chaldees. Who's that? Nebuchadnezzar. Who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary and had no compassion upon young man or maiden, old man or him that stooped for age. He gave them all into his hand. It was a slaughter in Jerusalem. And all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king, and of his princes, and these he brought to Babylon, and they burnt the house of God. So here's the destruction of the temple. And break down the wall of Jerusalem, and burnt all the palaces therein with fire, and destroyed all the godly vessels thereof, and them that escaped from the sword carried he away to Babylon, where they were servants to him and his sons until the reign of the kingdom of Persia. And that is going to figure into the prophecies of Daniel, by the way. In verse 21, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbaths. For as long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath, to fulfill 70 years. Every day was a Sabbath in Jerusalem for 70 years, for 70 years. Make up for all the Sabbaths that the people of Israel hadn't kept. Isn't that interesting? God does get his, doesn't he? He told them keep the Sabbath, and they refused. All right. How much time we got? About 10, 12 minutes? So here we go. God had sent prophet after prophet with stern warnings for Israel and Judah to reform, but they were stiff-necked. They were rebellious. So God chose a heathen nation to carry out his orders, namely 70 years of captivity, 70 years of Sabbath. About 90% of the population of Israel were either killed by war, massacred by the Babylonians, and only those who were skilled or strong enough for hard labor were taken into slavery. The Babylonians, they captured Jerusalem, they carried away the civilians as war captives, and not one was ever released. Not one was ever released. Among the captives, you find a young man, his name Daniel. And the first chapter of the book of Daniel will tell us how he rose from a captive slave to a high government official in both kingdoms, both the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of the Chaldeans. For the next 3 years after his capture, Daniel and his three companions, we'll read about them, will be oriented into the Babylonian culture and religion. They learn the language of the king's court and will become servants in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar. I would even tell you they're going to become eunuchs in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar. And throughout the book of Daniel, you will see that God will bring Israel down as a lesson, and the God of Israel will be exalted through whatever happens. All right. Well, I guess we will have time to get into Daniel. So if you turn to Daniel chapter 1, and in verse 1, that would be a good place to start as any. Daniel chapter 1. verse 1, just as soon as I get there. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. Again, may I remind you that the year 606 B.C., you read that, you read 605 B.C., you read 604 B.C., you pick your date. I'll just say 606 and let you put a question mark beside that. Supposedly, the Babylonians had excellent star dating. The Chaldeans, of course, were the origin of the wise men that came seeking the Lord after his birth, and they were able to do that by the reading of stars. But meanwhile, I'm not going to put near as much faith in their astrological calculations as some have. But Nebuchadnezzar attacked Jerusalem. Babylon itself dates back to the time of Nimrod. You remember him from Genesis chapter 11, the Tower of Babel, where they were building a tower unto heaven, and God didn't really care for that so much, and so he came down and confounded all the languages. The place is called Babel because of the people beginning to talk in different languages that sound like babbling. And that's where the place got its name, Babylon, meaning the gate of God. So when you see them building the Tower of Babel, a tower that would reach unto heaven, Babylon meaning the gate of God, they were all on the same page, weren't they? They were trying to depose God and substitute themselves right in. In the Assyrian, I talked before about archaeological evidence. In Assyrian tablets, it has the meaning of the city of the dispersion of the tribes. So there was a dispersion. And Assyrian excavations have shown that that's exactly the meaning of Babylon, the dispersion of the tribes. And that's exactly what happened in the Bible, is it not? Genesis chapter 11. Well, the city itself stood on the Euphrates in what is now Iraq. So we're over there staging a conquest in the land of the Chaldeans. And old Saddam Hussein, before his untimely death, thought he was modern-day Nebuchadnezzar. And he had even started the excavation of the ancient city of Babylon, and had every intention of restoring it to its former splendor and glory. That's just a side note. So, again, these things don't happen in a vacuum. They're not unknown. They're not only believed by those, by Christians, but there's a lot of this history is common to all Arab nations. It's not just you and I. So the city of Babylon stood on the Euphrates, about 200 miles above the Euphrates junction with the Tigris River. And that, it flowed, the rivers, they divided into equal parts. And the city, it gradually grew in size and grandeur. But at time, it became subject to Assyria. The Assyrian Empire had the city of Babylon in subjection, but Nineveh, which was the capital of Assyria, you find Nineveh in the book of Jonah, by the way, Nineveh fell, and then the Babylonian Empire, they threw off the Assyrian yoke, as it was, and became the city, kind of like the New York City of the world, of the financial world. So the Babylonian Empire, the city of Babylon itself, that's where all the action is. That's the place to be. That's the hub of all things at this time in the world. And under Nebuchadnezzar, it became a huge city. It became a splendid city by all accounts. You've heard of the Hanging Gardens, of Babylon. Nobody's ever found those, but, they're fabled to have occurred, and supposedly Nebuchadnezzar built those. Who knows whether that's true or not? But sooner or later, the city was occupied by Cyrus, king of Elam. and that was in about BC 538. So the Babylonian captivity is going to end with the ascent of Cyrus, king of Elam, and that when he captures Babylon. So we're going to deal in Daniel with that 70-year period, and then, of course, Daniel has some things to say well beyond that period. But meanwhile, Cyrus issued a decree that permitted the Jews to return to their own land. We're going to have to cross-reference to Ezra at some point, but Babylon ceased to be the capital of the empire, and it went into decline. Maybe much the way our nation is today in the United States. It went into decline. It was visited and attacked over and over again by hostile armies, and till all its inhabitants were driven from their homes and the city became completely desolate. And now it's just a big pile of sand. That's all that's left. On the west bank of the Euphrates, about 50 miles south of Baghdad. So there's your reference point. There's a series of artificial mounds of vast extent. And these are, at least purportedly, the ruins of Babylon. These ruins are principally the great mounds called Babel by the Arabs. And this was one of these mounds is probably the remains of what was the Temple of Belus. It was a pyramid almost 500 feet high. Pretty good size structure. And then there was the palace, and that was the great palace of Nebuchadnezzar. It's almost a square. You can tell by the mound in the sand. Each side of it's about 700 feet long. That's a big house. The heating bill was tremendous. There's a little town named Hilla near the site of Babylon, and that's built almost wholly of bricks taken from that single mound. Hilla is a town that exists right now, and they confiscated the bricks from the Nebuchadnezzar's palace and built the town. There's one mound. It's fairly lofty, and on the summit stands a modern tomb called Amran Ibn Ali. You can say that 10 times fast. That's probably the most ancient portion of the city's remains, and where the ruins of the famous Hanging Gardens, or maybe perhaps part of the royal palace, who knows what was there. But meanwhile, there was the utter desolation of the city, once called the Glory of Kingdoms. That's Isaiah 13, verse 19. Isaiah calls Babylon the Glory of Kingdoms. And in Isaiah chapter 13, starting along about verse 4, Isaiah prophesies the downfall of Babylon, but with righteousness shall she judge the poor and reprove the equity for the meek of the earth, and shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, with the breath of his lips, on and on. And then it comes down to that Babylon is not going to fare so well. I'm not going to read the whole thing. It goes through the end of the chapter. But meanwhile, Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 12, chapter 50, verses 2 and 3, they're all these things were foretold. Daniel foretells about Jerusalem falling in Daniel chapter 2. Verse 31, and we'll go there and take a look quickly. Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image, and the image's head, verse 32, was of gold, 33 legs of iron, 34, it's a description, 35, it became the whole earth, and 36, here's the interpretation, 37, thou, O king, art a king of kings. And for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom and power and strength and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell and the beasts of the fields and the fowl of heaven hath he given unto thy hand. So Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, ruled everything, the world. And verse 39, after thee shall rise another kingdom, and then more kingdoms, and on and on and on. And it tells about the downfall of Babylon, that Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar that his kingdom would not last forever. So the city of Babylon and its whole empire do in fact become conquered by the Persians under Cyrus. We're going to see again that name come up. The Persians were subdued then after that by the Macedonians by the Romans. There's the line of succession, and we're going to find all those empires in the book of Daniel. And that Rome succeeded to the power of the old Babylon. In some things, again, some things never change. So the power of Babylon is passed down through these kingdoms, and it was the Roman method to adopt the worship of the false deities that she had conquered, so that by Rome's own act, she became the heiress and successor of all the Babylonian idolatry that went on. Remember, these are the folks that said we can do without God and replace God. These are the people who invented sun worship. These are the people who invented the Madonna, the Mother of God. These are all the people who invented all these things. And all those things were introduced into the system of worship to the immediate successors of Babylon, that the Persians, the Macedonians, and the Romans. And consequently, all the idolatry of the earth, Rome, or as it's called in Revelation 17:18, mystical Babylon, is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. There's no other city in the world surrounded by seven hills. You can't make a mistake when the Bible talks about it and the horror of Babylon and all those things. It's Rome, no doubt about it, and the successor to all those, the mystical, Chaldean magical religion, the mystery religion, all those things. So that's exactly what's going on there. Well, let's go ahead and stop for the evening. We've gone an hour.